Thank you very much. Thank you. You're very kind, and you make me feel very welcome. And I'm very, very happy to be here. It's always extraordinary and wonderful to come to a place where people work against violence against women, accomplish a lot, understand that there's a lot left to do, understand that we can't be stopped, understand that if we stop, all of our work stops. Understand that as long as women are being hurt, our work is not over. We are not living in a fair and just and equal world. This war against women is not an abstract war. It's not a war that's a romantic war. Aha! The war between the sexes. What fun! No, it's not fun. It has not been fun for our half of it, who have had the war made on us. This war is real. It's a fist in your face. Some of you have come here from homes like that. Some of you are going back to them. Some of you remember them. Some of you help other people try to get out of them every single day. Men have a part of town in lots of cities that they enjoy calling the combat zone. And that's where they have women working to make sexual entertainment for them. And they admit through naming it the combat zone that they are making war on women. The reality is that all women live in a combat zone. It's real life. It's our neighborhoods. It's the streets that we're afraid to walk down because there are predators on those streets. It's the knowledge that we have when we go home. We're in a place that's even statistically more dangerous for us than that dangerous street was. We listen to the hostility of language that's used to describe women, all the dirty words that are supposed to mean us, parts of our bodies, who we are, what our natures are like. And those words are attached to actions, to behaviors, to ways in which we are treated. They are not accidental. They are not meaningless. They are not, quote unquote, just words. You know, we all hear it, that the most dangerous place for women is in our homes. But what does it mean? It means that at bottom, we are recognizing that women don't have homes, that women are basically homeless, that women choose between being on the street where they're in danger or having shelter at the cost sometimes of life and limb. Home is where we're killed most, where we're beaten most, and where our children are most often raped. We've talked about many kinds of violence today. Rape, acquaintance rape, a boyfriend, a date, a friend of the family. Marital rape, which takes place in every battering relationship. And the FBI, bless their little hearts, now tell us after we have told them that battery is the most commonly committed violent crime in the country. And yet people don't want to talk about the fact that the woman inside the relationship is also raped. Stranger rape, when the predator decides to reign over a neighborhood. He takes over a geographical terrain, and he introduces terror into the lives of every woman who lives there. Battery. We've just discovered it again. in the United States with the death of Nicole Brown Simpson. Donna Shalala said, it's a dirty little secret. Finally, it's out. Finally, it's out. What does that mean? Finally, it's out? The birth of the first battered women's shelters were established here, not the day after she was murdered. In Battery. People don't know what it is. They don't think about what it is. They don't understand that a captive is tortured in her home. And that we should be able to send Amnesty International in to document the abuse. And we haven't begun to take responsibility for the complicity of nearly everyone. Nearly everyone who hears the scream, who sees the bruises, who know what's happening, who do nothing, who do a little, who say hey to her. Hey, when you're ready, maybe I'll be ready. Who knows? Maybe I won't. He's the problem, not her. And so far as I can see, in this society, no one's ready to take him on yet. And taking him on means getting between him and her. And it means that she doesn't have to become a fugitive. And that he doesn't get to become an assassin. Prostitution, the use of women as a form of sexual entertainment for men. And we see in cities, segregated for men only areas in which there are plenty of women. But the women aren't there as human beings. The women aren't there as citizens. The women aren't there with the dignity and integrity of having a body that has boundaries. The women are there to be bought and sold, to be used, to be exploited, to be hurt if the guy wants to hurt them. We still see in cities and towns all across this country a form of sexual apartheid, where women are brought in as the entertainment and men are the citizens who use them, as if the Constitution says that men have a right to entertainment, and that entertainment can be at the expense of anyone who is chattel when the Constitution was written. The dehumanization of prostitution, the violence involved in prostitution, and I don't mean the violence of the battery that goes with prostitution. I don't mean that he beats her up and then fucks her. I mean the violence of having your body used by man after man after man after man, and then being told that it was your choice. And therefore you're responsible for what they do to you. They're the citizens, but you're responsible. They have the rights, but you're responsible. And we have the crime of incest that's committed against us. It's another form of rape in which the victim is a captive in a home, usually. And incest is a training ground. And it's a training ground for a lot of things. First of all, it's a training ground for being a woman. It teaches you that your body doesn't have boundaries to it that anybody needs to respect. That you can be touched if somebody wants to touch you. If they want to go inside you, they can go inside you. That's who you are. That's what you're for. Incest is also a training ground, a training camp, boot camp for prostitution. It sets up women for hopelessness and despair, to expect nothing more. And sometimes it's not really all that ethereal and spiritual, because daddy or stepdaddy is actually the pimp. Mothers in this country have been punished for standing up for their children, for trying to stop the raping father. And now in custody cases, when a woman says, my child is being molested by the father, it's seen as a ploy on her part to get custody, as if it's impossible. How could it be that this citizen, this man who can go anywhere and do anything, either would rape his child or, in the event that it's clear that he has, be rebuked for doing so? And at most we hear that he's disturbed and he needs help. Well, we need justice. And we need safety. And we need freedom. And when we have all of that, if anything is left over, he can have his help. We see that there's a current new refusal to even take the word of children about being abused. And if the child says that the abuse was organized and many adults participated, then we're supposed to take that as a symptom that's clear that the child has been programmed to say such a terrible thing. Well, adult citizens organize. And they trade, and they traffic in, and they sexually exploit children. And sometimes they do it singly, and sometimes they do it together. There was once in this country an underground that helped incest children who were going to be given to the rapist to get away. And the FBI took that underground very seriously and did everything they could to break it. And they did, they broke it. And I asked myself, which I would rather be guilty of, not believing a child helping the legal system to keep the child with the father through my inactivity, through my choice not to believe the child, or actively helping a child escape? Which would I rather be guilty of? Because I have to be guilty of one or the other. You see, I am doing one thing or the other. I am either ignoring it or I am doing something about it. Pornography is the DNA of male supremacy. It is the genetic fingerprint. It's the landscape. It's the geography. It's where you find the blood evidence. It's where you find the bodies. And you see the forensic pictures that have been taken of the crimes that have been done to them. The women look two-dimensional and dead. None of them are two-dimensional. Some of them are dead. They are the ultimate compliant women, because no matter how many times you roll the tape, they always do the same thing. And men fast forward to their favorite spots. And the women in the pornography can be very aggressive because they are told to be and have to be in saying, hurt me. I want to be hurt. I like it. And we are supposed to believe that that's their free speech, not the free speech of the pimp who's making money off of their bodies. And we're supposed to accept the hatred of women that's in the pornography, and we're supposed to believe that when men have orgasms to that hatred, that's all right. Not only is it all right, but something called the Bill of Rights protects it. It's never protected us. It doesn't protect us now. We have to think very seriously about what it means to sustain a resistance against the tyranny that is part of everyday life for women. We have to be serious people. We have to mean it. We can't just say it. And we can't just say it sometimes. We have to figure out what actually happens to us. We have to ask ourselves the question over and over again until we come somewhere near an answer. Why does it happen? We have to know how it happens. How do these crimes against women occur? How are they organized? How is the protection of them organized? We need to know what to call the things that are done to us that hurt us. Because the names that men have given them make them sound trivial, unimportant, and as if a woman's body, her life, her soul, the substance of her existence is not at stake. And so we need to confront the fact that men have defined the crimes, what the crimes are, and they've told us who does them and how they do them and when they do them, and they've been wrong. And the reason that we know they've been wrong is because these crimes have happened to us. We need to decide what to do. And before we decide what to do, we need to have the conviction that we must do something. It is very easy for Americans to think that there will be a happy ending even if we don't do something. There is not going to be a happy ending, not to this war against women, unless we manage to dismantle the structures that allow the crimes to happen, that protect the people who hurt us, wherever they exist, wherever those institutions exist. That means when they're part of the law itself. That means when they're part of the entertainment industry. That means when they're part of a profit-making so-called free market. We need to take our own experience seriously. It is a primary source of information. about male supremacy and how male supremacy works. In order to take our experience seriously, we have to be able to think about our experience. And in order to be able to think about what has happened to us, we have to be braver than we've been. And in order to be able to tell anybody what's happened to us, we have to be braver than we've been. Now, it's always interesting that with all the force that's used against women and all the real force, it nevertheless remains true that it appears that we are shut up very easily. She's crazy. Shuts us up. She wanted it. Shuts us up. It never happened at all. She's lying. Shuts us up. We close down instead of getting enraged. We need to get enraged. There are certain preconditions for violence. Violence against women, certainly. One, that each and every one of us is alone. That we feel alone. That we're divided from each other. Because, theoretically, at least each of us is hooked up with a man who keeps us divided from each other. That we have accepted that we are inferior. And we all have a million different ways in which we have accepted it. It's a lie, I believe, to say that we have purged ourselves of the valuation of ourself that says that we are less than they are. There is always a reason not to believe another woman, a reason that society will affirm. There is a hierarchy with men on top and women on the bottom. It has racial and class dimensions to it. What it means is that anybody who's not on the top has to live with being dehumanized, being objectified. Women are told that we actually have a nature that requires punishment. We like it. We enjoy it. For us, it's sexual. We like being hurt. When men push us, when they shove us, when they force themselves on us, we like it. Because it shows how much they really desire us. And that we provoke them into using force purposefully by saying no to them. And that no really means yes. We have been saying for the last 20-something years, no means no. I, an adult person, can say I want to be with you if that's what I want. And short of hearing it from me, you don't know it. You don't know a damn thing. We're supposed to believe that dominance and submission is natural, and that it's sexual, and that we all get a sexual kick from it. And women are supposed to get a sexual kick from being the submissive part of it, on the bottom, getting things done to us that we say we don't want done. And that conquest, sexual conquest, is natural. And that we like it. It's exciting for us as it is for the men. And the men say that they are predators. It is a male paradigm of sex, not a feminist one. In which they say, men are the hunters. You heard Newt? He wants to hunt giraffes. And the little lady's supposed to stay home. I mean, I think we were all bewildered. Why giraffe? I'm sort of thinking, well, at least, probably, hopefully, there aren't any giraffes around where he lives. So nobody's going to get hurt in the near future. But the fact of the matter is, the only time that men get angry about being characterized as predators is when feminists do it to try to stop them from being predators. In political terms, we have to deal with the fact that we live with an intolerable double standard. And the double standard isn't just sexual. That's a small part of it. It's a double standard for what it means to be a human being. What rights a human being must have. What integrity means to a human being. What it means to have credibility in the world. The difference between what it takes for a man to say something and be believed and a woman to say something and be believed. There's a difference in the standard of knowledge that men, no matter how ignorant they are, always know more than we do. That our experience counts for nothing. And of course, part of that is that in most places in the world, women are the least educated part of the population. And the bulk of the world's illiterates are women, as are the bulk of the world's poor. The final double standard that I believe the women's movement has not taken seriously enough are the ways in which men believe they own us. We've begun to talk about it when we talk about control of women in marriage, when we're looking at battery. Very few people know what a sinister word control is. Anyone who's been battered knows how sinister it is. That somebody actually thinks that he's the king and you're a serf. Anybody who's actually lived inside that system, whether in marriage, in prostitution, or in any other way, knows that it's impossible for the king to rule his kingdom without cruelty, without brutality, without the threat of force of arms, and without the backing of the state. And so, we're going to have to look at the normal things through which men express and reify their ownership of women. And one of those things, yes, is intercourse. Yes, it is. Intercourse is a way in which women were owned. Up until recent legal reforms that we initiated that made it a crime, still not in every state, only in most states, and not in most countries of the world, to rape your wife. Before marital rape was a legal reality, men had a right to sexual possession of a woman's body. And I suggest to you that when we look at crimes like stalking, when we look at battery, when we look at the men who kill when the battered woman has left, we are looking at the real meaning of sexual ownership of women. That men still feel it, whether it's legally real or not. And I would ask you to think about that. Because if we're still going to say that violence is abnormal, instead of coming from the normal ways in which men and women presume to live together, we're not going to be able to solve any of these problems. And I want to talk to you just very briefly about resistance. Honor must be given to those who rescue, to those who help, to those who give shelter to battered women, to those who help get prostituted women off the street, to those who deal with rape after rape, beating after beating, sale after sale of a woman's body. In thinking about the Holocaust, great honor is given to what are called rescuers, those who risk something to save somebody else. Now, we have systems, and especially in Minnesota, you're very well organized. You have systems of rescue. But you're complacent in the systems of rescue that you have. You think that they're enough, and they're not enough. The bravery of the rescue is lost because it's become part of a bureaucratic event. And the sense of emergency around women's lives is being lost. And I ask you to think about that. There's another area of intervention. Interference is probably the normal word, the therapeutized word, the socialized word is intervention. And that is to stop the injury while it's happening. He's beating her now. I see it. I stop it. How I do that may be difficult, but I do it. And I do not pretend that I have not seen what has just happened in front of my face and go on and live my life as if I am a queen of feminism and a queen of liberation. And that duty is incumbent on every last one of us. We also need what, out of deference to Linda Marciano, who was forced into deep throat, I call deep change. We need deep change. That means we need to stop rape, and we have to stop prostitution. It is not enough to pick up the injured women afterwards. It's not enough. And it can't be our goal. Our goal has to be to knock down everything in this society that props up rape and prostitution. We have a responsibility to weaken, in as much as we can, in so far as we can, every institution and social practice that makes rape and prostitution viable, easy, done with relative impunity. The political meaning of sexual abuse is important here. This is not like getting a sore throat. And it hurts a lot. And then in a while, it's over. Sexual abuse is not like that. Sexual abuse changes the person it happens to. And there is some evidence that it changes some of us so much that we can't anymore fight for our own rights. Because we don't have any sense that we have a right to anything. Sexual abuse robs us of the integrity, not just of our bodies, but of our consciences, especially towards ourselves. And so one of the things that we must do is to be strong enough and make a political commitment to remember what happened to us. Remember it. Remember it. Even if what we're remembering is that we were broken inside. And then when we remember and we know, we have a responsibility to create not just speech, but political activism around the ways in which we have been broken. And this goes beyond the individual. This goes to building a culture of resistance that absolutely refuses to stand still for brutality against women and children. We need to make the personal political. And that means facing one's own life, which is often hard. It means breaking the silence in which sometimes we feel safe. Yes. It means finding sisters, not just for conversation, but also for action. It means doing something real in the world that can be seen and experienced by other people. And healing is not enough. And I don't know if it's even possible, but if it's possible, it's still not enough. When we make the political personal, what we as women need to learn in order to have a political movement is discipline. That this isn't just a volunteer occasional activity. This is a way of life. We need patience with ourselves and with everyone else. Not too much patience, because we have too much patience. You see, men need more, we need less. But we need some, a little, that much. We need endurance. Now, I'm amazed at what women will endure in captivity. I'm sickened by how little women will endure to fight for freedom. We live with a lot of pain. Earn it. You're going to get punished for being a woman. What an indignity to be punished for a condition of birth. How much better to be punished because you resisted and your act of resistance mattered. Keep doing real work. Keep asking questions about the condition of women. Don't accept flattery. It's not politically useful. Kindness is, flattery is not. And the hardest thing, I think, for Americans is there is a price to pay. There is a price to pay. Yes, you will pay. So make up your mind to it. You can conform forever hoping you won't pay and you're still going to pay. Or you can decide that you're going to spend your life working for women's freedom, and whatever the price is, yeah, you're going to pay it. Because it's worth it.
And that was Andrea Dworkin, who spoke in Loring Park last week. And you're listening to the Lesbian Power Authority on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul. And we have a few community announcements.